My name is Chris Main, M-E-I-N, and I'm with, do you have your name in the full of your mind?
You want my, all my Christian names and...
Sure,
yes,
why not?
All right, Meriel Joyce Dunn. How's that?
Oh, terrific. And the date today is 31 July 1979, and we're in, I guess, the Colwood Machosin area, up on the mountain, Triangle Mountain. And Mrs. Dunn was with the Wrens during the Second War at Bletchley Park, and all the spy mystery business. And I'm just wondering, first of all, Mrs. Dunn, if you could tell us a bit about where you were born, when you were born, that type of thing.
Well, I was born in 1922 in Ashby-de-la-Zouche, Leicestershire, England. My maiden name is Matthews. I was 1922, and I was barely 17 when the war broke out. I stayed at school for, I can't remember whether I stayed at school or whether I left. No, I must have been at school for a year. I wasn't 17, I was 16. And I was going to be a nurse. Is this stuff relevant?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And I'd hoped to go to St Mary's Hospital in London, and the Blitz was on, and my mother wasn't very keen on my going up to London, nor was she very keen on my doing my nursing in a provincial hospital. One didn't know how long the war was going to last. I was getting a bit impatient, so I said, well, just until the war's over, I'll apply to join the Wrens. And I went into the Wrens on February the something or other, I can't remember, 1941. I can remember my Wren number, which was 11042. Isn't that funny? You can remember these odd things. And I went to Greenwich Royal Naval College, which was the recruitment establishment in those days. The Wrens were quite a small service, relatively small, and at that time we all went to Greenwich Royal Naval College, which was rather nice.
Yes.
Straight from school, I had no skills, nothing to offer at all.
Now this would be what, 39?
Well, it was. I actually applied to join in 40 and was called in 41, you see.
Oh, I
end
see.
Of 40, as soon as I was old enough. I don't think they took us until we were 18. I was 18 in October 40,
mm-hmm.
And I was called in February 41. The point about going into the Wrens for me was that I thought I wanted to go by the sea. Sooner or later, one was going to be called up to do something anyway, because it was beginning to work like that. And I would rather choose what I was going to do than just be pushed. And I thought I wanted to get to the sea. I joined as a writer, which was a fairly vague term. We spent 3 months at Greenwich Royal Naval College, incidentally being bombed every night, which was a little ironic in view of the fact my mother didn't want me to go to London. And we had no uniforms, those of us who were joining at that time, because the uniform depot in Deptford, I think it was, had been bombed a couple of times. So we were just in what we went in ourselves. The nearest we got to uniforms was an armband with WRNS on it.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing seemed to be happening about where we were going or anything, and all of a sudden...
No, you wouldn't be commissioned, is that correct?
No, I was just a Wren.
A Wren.
A Wren. All of a sudden, 8 of us, I think, or 10, I can't just remember, because I can't even remember the names of some of them now.
Mm-hmm.
Were sent for, I suppose individually, together with, I think, a leading Wren, and were told that, asked if we would be prepared to go on something that nobody could tell us anything about. At 18 you say yes, don't you?
Of course, yes.
And we were sent to Euston Station and told to get on a train on a platform, and we honestly didn't know where we were going. And we were told, or the leading Wren, the girl in charge of us, was told that once the train had moved from the station, the envelope that she was carrying, which would tell us what to do next, could be opened. I suppose we must have had a reserve compartment. I can't remember that. So off we went.
Kind of funny at the time, a little bit.
Not
too secure. Oh, I guess not funny.
No, not. I don't think so, because by this time the war had been on for 18 months. You know, and one was very much used to blackout conditions. Security propaganda. You know, there was a slogan which I think was probably going about then on posters. Don't talk, keep mum. You know, that sort of thing. Careless talk
loses
that.
This sort of thing. Yeah.
So, no, I don't think anybody thought anything was funny about that sort of thing, because by then all the signposts had been taken down, and names had been taken from prominent places, and not that I think for one moment it would have confused anybody, but you know, the theory was, and this was after all just after the Battle of Britain, wasn't it?
Yes,
and
it
at the Battle of Britain time it was really expected that we should be invaded, so everybody was very sort of security conscious, and it didn't honestly occur to me.
I'm just thinking of the cynical nature today of
yes, we weren't though in those days, and I'm not sure that if there were to be another war that one would be again. I mean, I know what you mean. I know really what you mean, and I suppose with hindsight it was a bit funny, you know, funny ha ha as well as peculiar.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't occur to me, and it didn't occur to the rest of us. And we were young enough, I think, to feel perhaps a bit important.
Now you would have, what, your uniform at this time?
No,
no. No uniform yet?
No uniform, Wren armbands, sealed orders, and...
And what, and totally divorced from your family at this point?
Oh yes, because my family's right in the Midlands.
Mm-hmm.
We were also told, and this I know was true, the people, the authorities at Greenwich didn't know where we were going or what we were going to do, nor did Wren headquarters. Now, I know...
Being seconded somewhere.
Yes, I know that later on we did understand that Wren headquarters had been asked if they would be prepared to send a small group of us on something as an experiment. And if it was successful, then they would want more. So we opened these things and we heard we were going to Bletchley, which meant nothing to anybody.
Did it say Bletchley itself? Do you recall?
I can't remember. It must have said something, because we wouldn't have known where to get out of the train, would we? When we got to... Not even sure that we went to Bletchley. We may have gone somewhere else and were picked up by a bus. I can't remember, but we were met. And we were taken to, what I understood later and realised was Bletchley Park.
The house itself.
Yes, well, a house in quite large grounds.
Yes.
And the grounds by this time had a number of hutments, yes, well, sort of, not necessarily Nissen huts, but prefabricated
sheds,
temporary buildings, you know, with sort of asbestos roofs and so on. And we were taken to somebody who was introduced to us, or introduced himself to us, as Commander Travis. He was in charge. You've heard his name before, I'm quite sure, if you've interviewed somebody else, because he became Sir Edward Travis.
Before we get there now, do you recall it all from the station to Bletchley itself, the mode of transportation? Were you in a...
Well, I think we were in a bus of some sort.
Blackout windows?
No. Bletchley is a terrible sort of one-horse place, it used to be in those days. And how it absorbed this peculiar group of people, I really don't know. Well, I've no idea what Bletchley thought of it. I honestly, because everybody who worked there was civilian billeted.
Yeah.
You know, there were no residences.
Yeah.
So everybody working at the place was dumped on somebody living in the area, either in Bletchley itself or one of the surrounding small towns or villages. Anybody who got any accommodation at all more or less had to take somebody who worked up there. And there was a very hodgepodge cosmopolitan mixture of people. There were Army, Navy, Air Force, civilian, women, men, British, Commonwealth, or it wasn't Commonwealth, ultimately there were Americans, sort of black, white, yellow, the whole lot. And they were, especially the civilians, not so much the people in service uniform, because there's certain sort of physical prerequisites before you get into a uniform, or there used to be.
Mm-hmm.
But amongst the civilian population, there was, it was a very odd lot. You could see that it was all brains and very little else. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The puzzle men, eh?
Absolutely. Sort of physically odd looking.
As well.
Yes. Mm. Because I remember being very, very impressed by this. It was a whole lot of nuts. Really. Really. Some of them so clever that they were on the border. You really could see it in their eyes. A great many of the fairly recent chess international names.
Yeah, chess seemed to be the key, didn't it?
Well, yes, there was a... This was an odd thing, anyway. They're mathematicians, of course, aren't they? Chess players. Good chess players. And there were obviously quite a lot of mathematical calculations involved at various levels in the place. Anyway, we were taken to this man, a sort of big teddy bear of a man, you know, an avuncular type.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely delightful to us, because we were, what, 8 or 10, was it? Kids of 18, 19, even the girl in charge of us was only about 20. We hadn't a clue what we were doing there. And
this would be Sir Edward.
Yes, so he was Commander Travis at the time.
Commander Travis, yeah.
And he took a sort of particularly fatherly interest in us. He took us over at that stage, because this little group, and said that we'd been brought there. He explained about security and Official Secrets Acts and things, which we had to sign to start with.
And before he said anything else, you would sign these?
Well, he didn't tell us anything at all, really. But he explained that we were being brought in as an experiment to operate some code-breaking machines which were being developed, at least they hoped they would be successful. And if our use of them, or our using them, was a success, and if the success developed, then there would be more of us. But we were there on a probationary basis, if you like.
So in essence, you would be the first Wrens.
We were the first people, actually, to be let... The first Wrens, yes, to be
Wrens.
Let loose on the... Now, you know what they're called, if you've been talking, do you?
They were
called bombs. B-O-M-B-E.
Well, there was the bomb in, what was it, the big one in, what was it, Three Hat?
No.
You said the term bomb, like in Bodyguard of Lies, refers to the master code breaker, whatever, if you will,
yes.
The machine. It was,
Well, they were, I realise now, the sort of prototype of computers. You know, they were the sort of, before... Really
there would be a number of them, is it?
Well, there were two or three, I think, when I got there. There was the original one. We gave them names. That was called Agnes. I used to work that. It really had a personality of its own. I can't remember what the others were called. But the original thing, which had been, we understood, assembled by the Hollerith Company at Letchworth.
It was British... Tabulation machine.
That's right.
Tabulating machine,
yes.
Company. Yeah.
Hollerith.
Now they were designed by Knox and Turney.
Well,
Turney?
No, I don't know.
Oh, okay.
That I don't know. All I can tell you is that there was this original thing, and then there was a sort of development of it which was a bit more sophisticated.
Ah.
And not much, but a bit. And next to it was another. It was rather like your prototype, and then the slight improvement on your prototype. And up to that point, the actual operation of these things had been done by people who had worked at the factory. The mechanical engineers,
mm-hmm.
who had actually assembled, worked on them, you know, on the factory floor, and built them. And they had been recruited into various arms of the services, and then fished out of the services to come and do something with these things.
Mm.
And so there were perhaps three or four mechanics.
Well, let me see if I got this correct then. Going chronologically, you got there, Commander Travis met you, explained the Secrets Act to you.
Mm.
Was there any mention of marriage and children and things like that? Were you told not?
No, not that I can remember. No.
Not that you can remember?
No.
Then
we were only about 18. We weren't thinking of marriage at that stage.
Okay.
Most of
no,
me.
I just wondered.
No, there was no sort of, no. So one thing that did emerge, but whether we were told that at the time or not, I can't remember, is once you're here, we're not going to let you go lightly. That, I think, was told us probably before we went. You know, are you prepared to go on the basis that you probably can't be posted or drafted?
You sign on for the duration.
Yes, and in fact, although people were occasionally drafted away for one reason and another, there weren't many. Once you got into that, you tend to have to stick for obvious reasons.
Certainly.
And even though in the end there was a very big contingent of Wrens, very few of them, relatively, were drafted to other Wren jobs.
I'm just getting in my own mind. Now you come into this into Bletchley, you're accepted on an experimental basis, I gather. Now I gather you would not see the Enigma machine itself. That would be in another area. Is that correct, or were you?
Well, I have a feeling that at some point I did see one, but certainly not at that stage. Certainly not at that stage at
your
all.
Your primary job is to work the bomb,
And
that would be. And its job would be what, to determine where the rotors and
that's
things
right,
would be on the
right,
Enigma
yes,
machine itself.
That's right, yes. The bomb consisted of, you know what the Enigma machine looks
yes.
like, don't you? We used to receive what was called a menu.
Okay.
You've heard that expression before, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
From one of the other huts. They'd received the gobbledygook, which had been picked up by Chicksands or wherever, you know, and sent as a series of letters which meant nothing to anybody.
Right.
I don't know what means they used to resolve how this menu should be made up, but we would receive a way of setting up the rotors on the bomb that was thought might present ultimately with
logical pattern.
Yes.
I'm thinking now, I gather you didn't speak German or read German.
No.
Which in itself is security, I guess. Is that
yes,
correct?
Well, yes. I don't think it mattered whether one did or it didn't, because
well,
we didn't.
How did you determine whether it was a logical pattern?
Well, we didn't. We
didn't.
We got the menu, and our job was to set up the rotors on the bomb according to this menu. In other words, if you like, the bomb had a series of drums,
mm-hmm.
which were rather, I suppose, like the drums on the Enigma machine. And the Enigma machine worked by having a pattern for the day, didn't it? So
yeah.
You set rotor 1 at A, rotor 2 at Z, rotor 3 at
right.
so and so. You then tapped out your message and it came out in this thing above.
Yeah.
Yes, and to be able to do anything with it, at the receiving end, you had to set the things at the
same
thing.
Way.
And then tap into the gobbledygook and out would come a sensible message. Now without the book telling you how to set these things, then you had to find out what the pattern was. And it would be what? I don't know, 26 times 26 times 26, wouldn't it? Which is a tremendous number.
4,200 years or whatever.
Well, whatever.
To break it by hand,
yes.
Yeah.
So these things revolve. If you like, they would start with ABC. So you'd set everything at ABC and then you'd set it at DEF and so on. And the things would revolve and would.
Through the possible combinations.
If there was a combination that meant anything at all, the machine would stop.
So what, if I got this correct, the bomb itself, if the rotor should be set up, and then automatically they would go through the possible combinations.
Mm-hmm.
And then if it started to make any sense at all to the machine, it would automatically stop.
Stop. And then you would take a reading off that and send it back to the people who had compiled the menu, who would then set that against what they had got, and if it produced sense, that was it, you cracked it. If it didn't, they started with a new menu, and you went through the whole ghastly process again, and so on, and so on, and so on.
And this would be a once-a-day process, is that correct?
Oh, no, it was what?
Once every couple of hours, or what?
Well, they were picking up stuff, all very routine stuff, from possibly hundreds of operators. There would be one set of codes for the Air Force, one for something else, one for something else, one for something else, and sub-bits, as far as I understood it, within those. And there were routine messages. Say at 2 o'clock in the morning, there would be a weather report from point A to point B, which might just say weather fair or storm brewing or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This would be a nightly thing. If you could crack that, you'd perhaps got the code for a whole range of things.
Right.
But only for 24 hours. So there was all sorts of stuff coming into us 24 hours a day. You would hope you could crack something fairly quickly, which would give you 24 hours of readability. But if after so many hours you hadn't, that whole lot was abandoned and you'd have to give that one up. In the meantime, you were probably trying others.
Other codes.
That's right. So it, as far as I can recall, there was never rarely was there a quiet period. If you weren't actually doing something that was current, you might very well be given something that was really out of date, but from the point of view of some other stuff they'd got in, it would be helpful if you could get at it.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
Now, you would be, I think we're jumping ahead, but that's fine. You were put on the first bomb, if you will, is that
mm-hmm.
correct?
Mm-hmm.
And you called it Agnes, and that would be what, Hut 3?
No, we were in, bless my soul, I can't remember if it was Hut 11 or Hut 9.
Okay.
There was a hut where we operated and nobody else, you know.
No, you would be
Hut
off.
3 fed us, Hut 8 fed us, and maybe Hut 6 fed us. I can't remember that.
Now, you would be pretty much off on your own, is that correct? You would enter the hut, shut the door, and...
That's right. There were several of us, obviously.
Several rents.
Yes. I mean, there was a group of us working at
mm-hmm.
at one time, and there was always one mechanic on. Now, this was right in the early days.
Mm-hmm.
But it grew, you see, as...
And it just kept growing and growing.
Oh, yes, and we finished up with several outstations, several quite big outstations. There was one at Wavendon, there was one at Gayhurst, there was a little one at Adstock where I ultimately went and was in charge. There was a very big one at Stanmore, and there was a big one at Eastcote. Both of those are in London. And in the end, the operation, you see, this started, as far as I was concerned, in 1941. But that had already, it was underway, it had already started to get going. And as the war continued, it got bigger and bigger and bigger. And I can't remember how many Wrens were involved in the end, but something like 2,000 on a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week basis with the sort of control point in Bletchley Park, if you see what I mean.
Yes, I see exactly.
After a little while, it got to the point, when we opened an outstation or two, it got to the point where we worked on 3 8-hour watches, and each watch had a controller and for quite a long time I was one of the controllers, until in fact this rotation of a week on this, a week on that, a week on something else, and then a quick changeover and 3 days off upset my tummy after about 3 years, and I had to go on to day work, which was how I went out to one of the outstations and just was in charge during the day. But we worked it on a basis of a controller and an assistant receiving all the menus and distributing them to the various, either the bombs in Bletchley or the various outstations, by scrambler telephone or telex, well, teleprinter.
So you would, I guess, well, the straw boss, if you will, or the good term, the senior administrator, I guess.
Well, they just called us controllers.
Just controllers.
Just controller, yes.
The room itself, get back to the early days of Bletchley, we're talking approximately, what, 1941? What, March? February, March, the summer?
About April, I think, yes.
Okay.
I think April or May, I can't just remember.
April, May, 1941.
I know that we were there at the sinking of the Bismarck, because they came hurtling in before it was on the news and said that, you know, it was one of the things, they used to give us these snippets of what had happened. In the early days, when there were very few of us, they would keep us very much up to date with our involvement. Later on, when there were a great many people, well, certainly the rank and file of the Wrens knew little except, you know, this wretched...
Turning the dial.
That's right.
Well, when you got to Bletchley, you were introduced to the machine, I guess, in the sense of what someone sat down and explained what your job was to do on the machine, but not how the machine worked or where it was going. Is that correct?
You sort of, you're going to do this, and this is a stage in the breaking of... I mean, we knew what we were doing in the sense that we knew that we were breaking codes, that this was a stage in the breaking of German codes.
But you didn't know the grand scheme, if you will.
No, and the extraordinary thing about Bletchley is that nobody knew the grand scheme. I mean, I'm not sure that I was aware of that then. One must be honest about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that other people in the place didn't know what we were doing. And we didn't know necessarily what was going on sort of over there or over there. And such was the nature of the place and the attitude to the work, but you just didn't ask because you knew that it was vital and that, I don't know, this sunk in somehow, without being dramatic. It sounds a little bit dramatic now, perhaps, but...
Well, just the need-to-know basis, and everybody didn't need to know.
I suppose... I do remember being told, and I suppose this must have been by Commander Travis, because he was the one... Well, we did get occasional security talks, but he was the one who told us in the first instance. He said that one of the difficulties with the... intelligence work in the Second War was how too much had been blown apart after the First War. Now, whether that was true or not, I don't know, but this is something that was stressed. And that involved in a war, intelligence was of paramount importance, and therefore the less everybody knew about what was going on, the better. And so you just didn't ask. And you just didn't ask.
As simple as that.
It was as simple as that. Nobody asked, nobody said. And we were all billeted out.
To get to that, you would be billeted out with the locals?
Well, yes, I was within easy walking distance, just across the railway line, with a Mrs. Rogers in Railway Street. A friend of mine, who came with me too, Pam Walker, she and I were billeted in this place, and then later on we were moved up to the other end of Bletchley, but as our numbers grew, and the outstations began to be projected, because there wasn't room in Bletchley for... The machinery was big, and you needed space. Places like Gayhurst... Well, I think Wavendon was the first place to be commandeered, and they started to take over appropriate houses within sufficiently easy reach, either for Bletchley or the places where they would open the outstations, and we went into residences, you know, I mean hostels, if you like. I know we moved to Crawley Manor, North Crawley Manor, and the household staff, the Wrens there, the Wren officer in charge of, you know, the quarters officer, and the people in the kitchens and the people cleaning the place, were told that they wouldn't know what we were doing, and we mustn't talk to them about it, and they mustn't talk to us about it, and we didn't.
What about, was it Mrs. Rogers you stayed with originally?
I stayed with the Mrs. Rogers, yes.
What was her...
I don't know. This was, she was an old, oldish lady, at least she seemed to me to be at the time. I don't know, she didn't ask, and we didn't say. As I say, Bletchley seemed, the place and the villages around seemed just to absorb the fact that there was something hush-hush going on at Bletchley Park, and nobody said. I suppose that, I don't know, I never really analysed it until now. I suppose they thought that that was their war effort, and as indeed it was, because it would be very inconvenient to have
nonsense going on, certainly.
Yes, and people dumped on you in your home and so on.
Now, what about when you
there must have been a cover story, I suppose, because I mean it could have been very easily discovered that there was an establishment in Bletchley. But what that cover story was, I don't know.
Now, when you would come off work, you would just totally divorce the place and then start anew, is that the idea?
Yes, there were recreational facilities in Bletchley Park, of a sort, but the house itself was not all that big. I mean, it was a big Victorian house, but the administrative offices, I suppose, were in it. A lot went on sort of in Bletchley itself. There was a dramatic society, and there was a this club and a that club, using Bletchley's own sort of parish hall or whatever. Really, when you came away from the place, you didn't go back until you were next on duty. You carried a pass, you could go back. You were always challenged, you were to produce your pass. It was never taken for granted that anybody recognised you. It was fair enough. Passes were sometimes...
Would you wear your uniform to work when you got it?
Yes, always. And we did have quite a lot of interesting people visitors. You know, in time, I mean, Churchill came down. I was on night duty when he came down, so I didn't see him. But we had biggish names were quite commonplace, ultimately.
Just while we're on names, I'm thinking, did you ever know of Knox or Turing?
I can't remember. It's no good my being clever about it and saying I possibly do, but you know, I can't even remember the names of the people who worked with me a lot of the time. Not really.
Would they even tell you their names?
Oh, yes. One I do remember particularly was Alexander. C-H-O-apostrophe-D Alexander. He was one of the big chess people. He wrote a chess column in The Observer or The Sunday Times for years after that. Now, I remember very well. Because we had a lot to do with him. I remember somebody called Sean Wiley, because I fell rather madly in love with him for a bit. I remember some of the other chess players, and I think one of them must have been Harry Golombek, because I remember one had a funny name and I couldn't remember what it was, and I think that's who it must have been. I used to have coffee with him in the early days when there weren't very many of us.
Were there great chess games going on at lunchtime?
Oh, occasionally. I wouldn't say, I don't know whether there were great chess games. This was sort of, you know, in the coffee lounge, there was a cafeteria or a restaurant.
Well, you ended up eating on ships in this cafeteria, didn't you?
Oh, God, yes.
So many people.
Things in the middle of the night, and yes, terrible upside down business. You know, it's no wonder one's tummy was played havoc with. I'm really quite Victoria after about 3 years of it. Because we had one whole week working from 8 till 4, and we came off on Sunday, and would go on at 4 o'clock on Monday and work for another week from 4 till midnight. And we'd come off on the Sunday at midnight and go on at midnight on the Monday. And we'd have another week from midnight till 8, and then come off at 8 on Monday and go on at 4 on Monday, and come off at midnight on Monday and go on at 8 o'clock in the following morning, come off at 4 and have 4 days off. But you know, your tummy and your sort of sleep pattern
will be shocked.
Well, you'd only just got used at the end of one week when you switch the whole thing. And if you've ever come off...
No, I work shift, I know what you mean.
Yes, you come off in the morning and find yourself faced with kept hot breakfast in a hot cupboard, or at 2:30 in the morning you go in and have what would otherwise be sort of midday meal, or you try to. Well, after about 3 years, you know, it was sort of not too good.
I'm wondering why they would, do you know if there's any rationale for the weekly business instead of saying putting you on a month of nights or a month of afternoons or a month of days?
I don't know. I remember when I went to see a doctor about this tummy affair, he said, I can't understand why the services do it like this. In hospitals, we put people on night duty for 3 months at a time to give them a chance to...
acclimatize or whatever.
So I think it's just a service thing. You know, it never occurs to them that the body doesn't like it too much.
And of course you're young enough and hardy enough.
Oh yes, you sort of survive a great deal of it, because in the bits of off-duty time you have, you live it up hard as well. Don't you? I mean, London wasn't too far away. It was only 40 miles. And so one.
Did you get much time off?
Well, that sort of time.
Like you get 4 days off and you fly to London?
Yes, one would go down onto the main road and hitchhike down to London. And, you know.
What would be the haunts for the Bletchley Park crowd?
Well, I don't know. I had a boyfriend down in London for part of the time, so, and I had friends in Surrey, which was just south of London, so there was lots to do. And we were, Bletchley is just about equidistant between Oxford and Cambridge, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I had quite a lot of friends in Oxford, contemporaries or near contemporaries, who were up at Oxford. My father's a schoolmaster, and I knew quite a lot of young men.
Mm-hmm.
I was suitable. Very... What?
Suitable young men, or...?
Well, they were quite suitable for the time. I think I was a terrible bore to them, actually. I used to ring up and say, I'm coming over, and they were terribly good. They entertained me, and as far as it was possible to entertain anybody. And there was a railway service between Bletchley and Oxford at that time. In fact, there was a point when Oxford was about the only place one could go to, because just before D-Day all service leave was stopped, and service movements were stopped outside of a radius of something like 20 miles. I can't remember the precise figure, but I know Oxford was just inside it, and so we were still able to get to Oxford.
That was it.
Well, that was not bad. I could
not
tell.
Bad either. Did you realize that you were under the authority of MI6?
No.
You were under
no,
the authority
of... No, but peculiarly enough, our naval, I can't think what you call it, but you know...
Commandant of Rennes?
Well, the Navy thing is divided up into things like HMS Pembroke and so on. At Pembroke's Chatham, I think. I can't remember the other things. But we hadn't got a category. You know, I told you I joined as a writer.
Yes.
And people were telephonists, or they were telegraphists, or they were cooks, or they were whatever. And we became P6, HMS Pembroke 6, which I think is significant with hindsight. I didn't realise at the time, obviously. And we were also told we were on special duties X. That was our category.
Would there be much promotion?
Well, as it got bigger, yes, there was a fair bit. As far as I can remember, there was actually no promotion to officer level other than the people who were working on the domestic side of it.
That's sorry, I don't follow you. By
well, the girls that were working, that were involved actually with the Bletchley operation, I don't think anybody was promoted to officer. I don't know why. I finished up as a chief petty officer.
Well, that's God's right-hand man, so...
Well, yeah. Actually, I did far better than having got a commission, because, you know, you don't get mess bills. I had a room to myself. The officers were sharing. Came in and went out as I wished, and so on. So.
I think, would the money be satisfactory?
You didn't think about that in those days.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you what I finished up by earning, £100 a year. Well, I think 110. But you see, you have your full keep, your uniform provided, and I don't know what £110 a year is.
It's probably worth $5
money.
A pound anyway, yeah.
I don't know. If that is not, you just don't, I mean, you don't think about that sort of thing in wartime at all.
No, understanding that, but I'm just wondering if you were running out of money while living in Bletchley itself, or would you have much time to spend your money?
Not a lot, and there wasn't much to spend it on.
It is wartime, so.
Well, I mean, time went on, the sort of consumer goods became fewer and fewer, and if you hitchhiked, you didn't need money for travelling.
Description of Bletchley Park, it's described as a gloomy Victorian...
well, it was a Victorian house of no great architectural beauty.
Nice.
Gloomy.
How would you describe it?
A fairly standard-looking Victorian house in what had been, obviously, a very beautiful large garden, which was now more or less filled up, or largely filled up with some prefabricated buildings and things that had been put up in a hurry. Traces of the garden still. I remember there was a pool, because I remember during the night sometimes, if there was 5 minutes and I had to wake myself up at about 2 or 3 in the morning, I used to go out and walk sort of in the bits of the garden where it was possible. There was a little pool. Bletchley Park was the sort of Victorian house that is fairly familiar in parts of England. You know, it had obviously been built by somebody who had a bit of money and big red brick thing with a bit of panelling inside and so on. We were in some very beautiful houses, some of the older houses around which were taken over, like Gayhurst Manor, that was lovely. And,
what about your messing facilities in that sense? Would there be a wren's mess?
No, when we worked at Bletchley, we ate with everybody else, you know, cheek by jowl with
rank segregation,
because a wing commander could be working alongside an aircraftman, could be working alongside a captain, could be working alongside a civilian. I think what had happened really was that if people were needed for whatever reason, wherever they were hauled in.
Regardless.
And they just got on with whatever.
Jobs didn't hold particular ranks.
Well, I suppose there must have been people in charge of the administration of the work. Yes. No, not necessarily. Except that, I suppose in our setup, a leading wren and a petty officer and a chief petty officer became responsible for various for various areas.
I gather there wouldn't be a common. Would there be a commons room, like a bar or a lounge area?
I don't remember there being much in the way of a bar. There might have been. I don't remember there being a bar. There was what I suppose had been the drawing room in the place. I think this was a common room where we sat and had coffee. I can't remember an awful lot about that, because really, after about a year and a half, when we got our own quarters, quite frankly, when you were on duty, you didn't have a lot of time. You would have perhaps 20 minutes or half an hour for your meal. You didn't have a lot of time to go and sit in a common room.
Yes.
Meal times were staggered when you were on watch. And when you weren't on watch, you weren't in Bletchley Park anyway. So,
yes.
Except in the very early instances when the pressure wasn't on,
mm-hmm.
you know, when there was time perhaps to go and sit in a common room and have a cup of coffee, I don't remember there being much other than just going over and eating and coming back.
Well, it wasn't a question, if I'm correct, when you were working the bomb, you got your menus and you cracked it, say it was successful.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a question of just shutting down for the day. It was a question
of continuing on. No, because you would clear your machine of whatever, and then there'd be another one in it straight away. And the on the staff, there were these mechanics
mm-hmm.
who, if something went wrong, of course, immediately had to get to and round the back and unravel whatever was wrong and put it right.
So I'm thinking there'd be much breakdown time? Or
Some. It all depended. It was in the days of valves. So they were very big machines by comparison with a similar machine to do the same sort of thing today, perhaps.
What was the actual physical, I guess, description of the hut where you were in itself, intellectually?
Ours was actually a brick building with a flat roof and no windows. And the flat roof was supposed to be bomb-proof, but I very much doubt it, but it was a thick concrete roof.
Mm-hmm.
We had no windows, and so we worked all the time in artificial light. And in fact, in the winter sometimes, one didn't really ever see daylight because we perhaps came on duty when it was dark. Off duty when it was dark. And except perhaps for dashing across for your lunch, you wouldn't see anything at all. I think the theory about the no windows was that nobody was to see what went on in there. And I'm sure that, you know, I'm sure that was so, because in other places, whatever went on didn't look different from what would go on in any office, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly there was something going on in the hut that I worked in which was different from anything else.
You know, these bombs made a terrific racket, is that not correct?
They made some noise, yes.
I've heard a description of them as being like thousands of knitting needles.
Yes, I would think that would be about right. Because they're going round like that.
Like ratchets, I guess, then.
That sort of thing. And a lot of things doing that at once, you know. And you've got them sort of out of... You know, this one's going here, and that one starts up at a different time, so they're going out, they're out of phase. You see what I mean? So I suppose, yes. I can't remember that mm-hmm. that was any particular problem.
It wasn't that noisy, but it did make a noise. What about the physical size of them? Were they, 8 feet high?
Well, but certainly bigger than I am. But on the other hand, one could reach.
All the dials.
Mm-hmm.
Was it in a sort of a case type of thing, or was it an open back?